Now introducing our speaker. So, as I said, Bobby handed me a list yesterday with three people that he had asked to read stuff. And as you can see, he picked some sobriety warriors. And that's the kind of guy he is. You know, surrounds himself with men like us. You know? And I heard Bobby tell a story from the podium several months ago, and he told my story. You know, we both got originally sober in the third edition, and it wasn't the third edition that failed; it was us that failed, and then we made it back around. And his talk impacted me a lot. I really, really, really hope that it does for you what it did for me, maybe even more. So, this morning I introduce you, Bobby O.
Good morning, everyone. Definitely want to start by thanking Alan for the opportunity to speak and asking. And y'all be kind to him. This is probably going to be the last time that he's ever asked to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous after I get done talking. The committee is going to say, don't let Alan do anything ever again. I definitely want to thank the committee for everything that you've done to make this weekend possible. It's amazing to have this many men in one place all striving to do their best to get sober and to change their lives. To all the men that cooked on Friday night, thank you very much for an amazing meal, some wonderful barbecue, and I appreciate that very much. Nick, thank you for reminding me of where I don't want to come from or where I want to go back to. You know, jails, institution, and death are horrific, and I appreciate you reminding me of that. Griffin, thank you for your youthful energy that you provided, reminding me that I'm also not unique, that I screw up things on the first day as well, in that sense. And in Ben's talk for me, what I received was hope that someday I may be able to have a relationship with my 24-year-old daughter. Just because I'm sober doesn't mean I get those things back. But Ben gave me hope, and I appreciate that. And with Dave, what I received was the value and the importance of continuing to do work, even in multiple-year sobriety. The value of looking at sexual shadow and growing from that to become a better person is of grave importance for my sobriety. And last night, Matt, I appreciate hearing the value and the importance of going back and being of service to those that were there at the beginning. And those are very important. So, and Ricky, I got some coffee up here. And water. Over the past couple of years, my heart has kind of been heavy with something that was wrote in the big book. And it tells me that my life and the man that I am is continuing to shift in multiple ways. Don't come up here, security. We don't need nothing. So, Dr. Bob wrote this, and I believe it is with the greatest of intentions, but I've taken a heavy heart with the comment. He said, if you think you are an atheist, an agnostic, or a skeptic, or have any other form of intellectual pride which keeps you from accepting what is in this book, I feel sorry for you. And I take exception with that because I attended some meetings of non-believers in God. And I wondered if the way I felt about sitting in that meeting and talking about a God of my understanding and feeling uncomfortable and feeling not welcomed was exactly the way somebody that's an atheist or an agnostic feels whenever they come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I swore I would never allow that to happen again at any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous I went to. So the way that I think this should be is, if you think you are an atheist, an agnostic, or a skeptic, or have any other form of intellectual pride which keeps you from accepting what is in this book, then welcome. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Bobby Obermeyer, and I'm an alcoholic. Let's grab a cup of coffee. We'll go sit down for a couple hours, and we'll talk about what you don't believe in. And then we'll find a solution in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that allows you to get sober and to receive this gift. Because everybody is welcome in Alcoholics Anonymous. I spoke a couple of years ago, and my story is just my story. That's exactly what it is. It's mine. It may never be yours. You may like it. You may not like it. Does anybody know what this black box is that was put up here? I was kind of nervous. As somebody? Great. That's fine. You just leave it. Whoever he is, I'm just fine. I'm just fine. I just saw it put up there. I was like, what is that?
You wanted to cover the rock too.
Bring them. Who is it? Who?
You said everybody's welcome.
Ron Jackson.
Well, welcome, Mr. Jackson. Thank you. Sorry, Mr. Jackson. Woo!
Stop it.
Because I can't sing? Yeah. Or because I can't dance? Yeah. Or both. Great. So we're going to get into this thing, and I don't know how much time I have. He took those minute things. I hit him. I was like, I'm not worried about the 5 minute thing or the 1 minute thing. I'm going to do what I want. It's just the way I roll. Anybody ever read A Religious View of AA in the big book? Edward Dowling of Queen's Work staff says, Alcoholics Anonymous is natural. It is natural at the point where nature comes closest to the supernatural. And in my sobriety, I have seen so many amazing things. And I'm going to start way in sobriety first. In 2011, when I was in Columbus, Georgia, going to meetings, there were two men that showed up, Jim and Bob. And Jim and Bob had moved to Columbus from New York, where they originally got sober and were going to meetings, because Bob's dad was dying. And they wanted to be there for the final transition. And they would come to meetings. And for a year, I would watch them come to meetings and talk about what was going on. And everything that they were doing to deal with what was imminent, that the father was going to pass. And they showed me in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, every day that I saw them, the things that they needed to do in order to stay sober at the loss of a parent. On October 12th of 2012, my mom had a massive heart attack and passed away. Very suddenly. I was at my brother's house. We were watching the Braves game. It was the last playoff of the game for the season. It was Chipper Jones' last baseball game ever. And we got a call at the end of the game that my mom had had a heart attack and had passed away. God had sent me two men 11 months earlier to show me precisely the things that I would need to do to get sober and to stay sober through that event. Called my sponsor, packed up the car, and left and went straight to St. Louis for the funeral. And it was tough. My mom was my rock for a very long time. And I returned from that event, as catastrophic as it is, because there's nothing exciting about, you know, going to plan a funeral for somebody, because they want to know what kind of colors you want. They want to know what kind of music you want. They want to know what Bible verses you want. And I'm just like, overwhelmed. And the great thing was I had a relationship and a reliance and a dependence upon a God of my understanding that helped me make it through that event sober. I got back to Columbus and I went to my home group, and the only thing I knew to do to get out of myself was to chair the meeting. And I chaired the meeting. I don't know what the topic was, but at the end of the meeting, this young guy came up to me and says, "Hey, I just got a DUI, I'm in treatment, I need a sponsor." And I said, "Okay." I said, "Let's go through the steps, we'll get you sober." Nick was the first man in Alcoholics Anonymous that I went through all 12 steps with. Nick was the first man in Alcoholics Anonymous that I went through all the 12 traditions with. And in the step 5 of the 12 and 12, it says, until we do that with somebody, until we share without candor all of ourselves and listen to somebody else do it, then we truly don't belong in Alcoholics Anonymous. It says, until we have taken with complete candor of our conflicts and had listed them and listened to someone else do it, to do the same thing, we still didn't belong. Step 5 is the beginning of true kinship with man and with God. And when I got done doing that work with Nick, it was absolutely amazing. It was a gift to watch another man's life change. Nick got into a relationship at a year sober and got married, and they had 3 kids. Nick used his GI Bill from the military to go back to college and got his master's degree from Auburn. And absolute gift. And yesterday was Nick's 42nd birthday. It would have been. The day after Thanksgiving, Nick hung himself because he could not or would not accept what this program offered. And that is the truth of the disease, of how cruel and hostile it is. I am in here with the men, a room of a massive amount of men that can control and take care of any problem I have if I tell you about it, if I let you in, if I let you listen. But if I keep it in, then it's going to take me out. Nick was a captain in the U.S. Army, and I miss him dearly. And it was pointless. But it was his solution. I can't judge it. It just doesn't make me happy. So I'm sorry to start it off on a sad note, but that is the truth about the disease of alcoholism. I'm not going to sugarcoat that. So I met Alan 35 years ago at a treatment center in Atlanta called Straight. It was a youth detention center is what it was. It was a long-term hardcore adolescent treatment center is what they called it, but it was a youth detention center. And we met back up last year when I was speaking in Atlanta, and I talked about the treatment center. He's like, "Oh my God." And he's the only person that I've ever met that went to that treatment center besides me. "You went there? Oh my God. We're going to talk after the meeting." So I came to Alcoholics Anonymous young. I'm an alcoholic just like you. There's nothing different from my drinking career from yours that's going to be any different. I didn't drink anything different. I didn't use any different drugs. I did all the same stuff for the same reasons you did, because I'm full of fear, I'm full of anger, I'm full of guilt, I'm full of remorse. I don't belong on the planet. My father was abusive. My mother was whatever. All the same reasons. There's nothing different about me being an alcoholic than you being an alcoholic. The truth about what I say, "I'm Bobby, I'm an alcoholic," what that means is I don't want to be here. I would much prefer to be out there drinking and drugging. That is where my natural state is. Here, uncomfortable. Very uncomfortable to be here and to be open. Because when I do that, I give you the power to reject me. And that power to reject me would kill me. Because I can't handle that. That's the importance and the value of having a relationship with the God of my understanding today. Started drinking when I was maybe 15, very minimal. When I turned 16, let me give you a little more stuff though. My sobriety date is July 16th, 2006. I have a sponsor named Darzell. I have a home group named the Spiritual Awakening Group I'm active in. And currently I don't have any sponsees because I just moved from Savannah, Georgia to Columbus, Ohio, and turned all my sponsees in Savannah over to some new men, and now I'm hunting for new guys in Ohio. First, I've got to figure out how to change Alcoholics Anonymous in Ohio, and then I'll find some sponsees. If you've ever moved, you know, wherever you go, just don't do it right. So 15, started doing a little bit of drinking, a little bit of dabbling, not much. July 16th of 88, I got my driver's license, I got a car, I had a date, I got in my first drunk accident, same night. Which tells you I probably shouldn't be drinking at all, if that's the first night. I got water, but thank you. Welcome, Alan. Anything else?
You're an alcoholic, so.
So that should have told me that I really shouldn't have been drinking anyway. I'm not good at it. I mean, y'all talk about drinking and driving all the time. I was just not good at it. A couple of months later, I convinced my sister to sell me a dime bag. So she sold me a dime bag, and she told me, she said, whatever you do, don't get caught with that. And so that night, you know, I took my broken car out on another date and got arrested with that dime bag. Strike two. I am not a good alcoholic. I am not a good addict. I don't play this game very well. That arrest had me into court. I was court ordered to either the youth detention center or treatment, so I went to treatment. And I was 16 years old when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would go to those meetings and I would say I was Bobby an alcoholic. I didn't say it because I believed it. I said it because you said it. You said you were Steve, you were an alcoholic. You said you were Bill, you're an alcoholic. You said you're Kevin and I'm an alcoholic. I was like, I figured it out. That's what I need to say. It's the only reason I said it. I left that first treatment center after 56 days. I was drunk in 4 hours. A week later, I was up at this other treatment center in Atlanta. I was up there for about a year, and I left when I was 18 because I felt like I wanted to get sober, and I came back to Columbus, Georgia, and I got sober. I got a home group. I got a sponsor. I started doing the steps. I got active in Alcoholics Anonymous. First prepaid convention I went to in Columbus, Georgia, a bunch of young people showed up. They were starting the Georgia Conference of Young People in AA. I got involved in that. I was going to assembly. We were doing Pine Mountain Fellowship over in Pine Mountain. We started a men's conference called Men on the Mountain. In 91, 92, 93, I came to the Rock. My last Rock was 1993 for the blizzard. And I'll tell you, if you were here, was anybody here for 93? That was, you know, I felt like it was a war zone. You know, all those tops of those pine trees just popping off from the ice and just coming down, and you just never knew which one you were going to do, so you couldn't walk anywhere. It was not safe, and I left. I took my little Nissan Sentra, I drove out somewhere, called my girlfriend, said, hey, I'm coming back to Atlanta. It took me, hello? Oh, I thought that died. Whew. It took me 4 hours to get from here to Atlanta on the interstate. It was ridiculous. So I was very involved in Alcoholics Anonymous from the get-go. So stayed sober for about 9.5 years. At about 6 years, I kind of stopped going to meetings, and I felt like I'd had enough. I learned everything. And a lot of that was probably youthful ego or pride or something like that, but I stopped going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And just because I stopped going to meetings didn't mean I just woke up drunk the next day. It took about 2.5 years before I got drunk again. At that time, 9.5 years sober, the way my life looked was I would wake up in the morning, I would say goodbye to my wife and my child, I would go to my first job, then I would go to my second job, then I would go to my girlfriend's house, and then I would go back to my wife and my child. And that's the way I was living, on Bobby's own devices. I got drunk. My wife divorced me. She remarried very quickly. And the guy she married was living in Hawaii. And I was devastated. And my boss came up to me. I was in the restaurant business. He said, look, I know somebody that has bought this franchise, and if you want to go, I can probably get you a job. So a couple days later, I had a ticket to Honolulu for an interview. And I went, I interviewed, and I got the job. And so I had went to Hawaii with every intention to be a father to my daughter. That was it. In the 2+ years that I was back in Honolulu, I think I saw my daughter 3 or 4 times, and that was it. What happened was when I landed on that island of 2 million plus people, nobody knew Bobby was an alcoholic. Nobody knew that Bobby was in recovery. And so I began to drink and use the way that y'all had talked about in all the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous I ever went to. You know, you said you drank this, you drank here, you did that. I just went off. And it was awful. And I was the manager of a restaurant. So if you've ever been in a restaurant, front of house is usually responsible for beer, liquor, and wine. And we have to do an inventory, which was great because I already knew how to do an inventory. Fear, resentment, sex, beer, liquor, wine. I had it. I was good. And so at the end of the month, I would do the inventories. And my boss would come to me, and he's like, Bobby, I don't know what's going on with these numbers, but, you know. And I'm like, look, bartenders, I mean, we're a vacation spot, so bartenders are pouring a little heavy on the Mai Tais and stuff like that. But I'll talk to them, and we'll get it better next month. The truth was that Bobby was going in there and saying, well, tonight I'm going to take a bottle of vodka, so I just need to remember at the end of the month, when I count vodka, I need to put 8 rather than 7. But I'm going to take a bottle of vodka, and tomorrow I'm going to take 2 bottles of wine, and the next day I'm going to take a bottle of Jack, and the next day I'm going to need to take a case of beer. And so then I had to remember at the end of the month everything I took. If I could have remembered, I probably would have done better on the inventory, but I couldn't. You know, so they were always whacked out. One day the big boss calls, and he says, I need you to come to the restaurant, I need to talk to you. And so I figured the gig was up. And I go, and he says, look, I want you to go over to Kona, the big island, and I want you to manage that restaurant because I'm firing the other manager because he's been drinking and drugging with the staff. And I was like, yeah, you should. That is inappropriate. It's unprofessional, and you should fire him. What that really did was that was validation that I was a successful alcoholic. It's exactly what that was. I was doing the exact same thing, probably worse, and I wasn't getting caught. And so I went over there, and I had 3 days. Interview, find a place to live, and then goof off. I went over, oh my gosh. Went over, did the interview, aced it. People liked me. Second day, I was trying to find an apartment that didn't work very well. I spent the entire day at the bar. And third day, the guy that interviewed me says, hey, we're going to go hiking. And I was like, okay, yeah, let's go hiking. We're going to hike up to the lava fields. And so we go down the road and through some gates and stuff like that, and we start hiking. We stop by the store, and he says, we're going to get some snacks and drinks. And he goes in and he gets snacks and drinks. He gets like granola and some water and stuff like that. And I go and I get beef jerky and Heineken. And I remember him looking at me like, what is wrong with you? And I'm like, it's my day off. You know, of course I'm going to drink. So we get there, and we start a backpack, 6-pack of Heineken, and whatever snacks, beef jerky or whatever, my backpack. And we start hiking. And I'm going to tell you that this is the first time that I have ever been anywhere that has been exactly the way I felt on the inside. If you've ever been to a lava field, it is lifeless, it is black lava, it's jagged, it smells like sulfur, it's hot, it is void of all life, which is exactly the way I feel on the inside. And I'm trudging, I'm shredding my shoes, I'm drinking this hot Heineken, sweating alcohol out of every pore, and we get up to the lava fields. And I will tell you that it was some of the most amazing reds and yellows and oranges that I have ever seen in my life. The heat from lava is unlike anything you've ever felt. It is absolutely different than the sun. It's absolutely different than fire. It is a heat unlike anything else. And I stood there, and it's the first time that I was close to anything spiritual on that island. And today I call it, I was blessed by Pele, the goddess of fire. And I turned around and I started hiking back to that car, and I made a decision that if I stayed on that island, I was going to die. I was either going to die drunk alone or I was going to kill somebody. And I got back and I called my boss and I said, hey, I need to go back to Georgia. Thank you for the opportunity. And I just knew that if I could get back to Georgia, if I could get back to Columbus, if I could just get back to the Agape Center in Columbus, Georgia, I could get sober. And I went, and I did. I packed up my stuff, shipped my car over on the boat, picked it up in California, detoxed for 2 weeks across the United States. I do not recommend that to anybody. At all? Go to a doctor? And I got back to Columbus, and I went to that meeting, and it was a new meeting at the Agape, and it was on a tradition. And I was like, wait, God, that's not what I need. I don't need traditions today. I need something else. But it was the end of the tradition. It said, less problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. And I had let the ego and the pride of being this big-time manager in Honolulu just divert me from everything I needed to do in my life. I came back to Georgia, and I couldn't get a job in Columbus, so I went to Macon, picked up another restaurant job. Did that for a year, you know, white-knuckling it because you know, it's 50, 60-hour weeks, couldn't get to meetings. Finally quit that job and then got into the steps of the sponsor and did the best that I could. The issue with my sobriety then was that it's easy for me to do step work, and it's easy for me to do service work and stay sober. And that's kind of an osmosis deal. But when the crap hits the fan, I don't have anything to defend for me. And so at 4 years sober, I was engaged to a girl, and that was my higher power. And came home from a vacation trip with my brothers and called her. She said, look, the relationship's over. All your stuff's at your sponsor's house. I don't want to ever see you again. In a moment, everything in my life had been taken away at 4 years sober with no notification and no warning. And I was devastated. I had no relationship. I had no reliance. I had no dependence upon a God of my understanding that could help me stay sober through that moment. I knew step work, I could go to meetings, and I did. I'd go to meetings, I'd sit on the couch and cry, and cry, and cry, and that was it. We thought we were going to get back together, but we did not. And I made a horrific decision that I was just going to go try and kill myself. And I took off on a Friday night, about 5 or 6, and loaded up the truck with another six-pack of Heineken, but I added Crown Royal, I added a cigar, and Pink Floyd the Wall. And I put that CD in, and I rolled up those windows, and I started drinking, and I started driving. And my first plan didn't work. Second plan kind of did. I regrouped the next day on Saturday, and found a place that I was going to do the deal that I was going to try and do. And Sunday, this place that I parked was a construction site. And early in the morning, all these workers showed up and found this truck running locked with a hose in it. And they broke into my truck and they pulled me out and threw me straight in the mud and went to work. We don't want any part of what's going on here. So I think they called the police and the fire department or whatever. And so I came to. When I came to, I was in four-point leather restraints. My clothes had been cut off. There was mud. There was charcoal. There was tubes up my nose. There were nurses. There were doctors. There was police. There was my father. There was the gun. Everybody's yelling at me, wanting to know what drugs I'd taken. And I kind of levitated out. And this is the first time, this is where for me, in Bill's story, he says, simple but not easy, a price has to be paid. And the price is the destruction of self-centeredness. It's not the shuffling. It's not the bruising. It's not edging out of the way. It is the destruction of self-centeredness. And I was destroyed in a way at that moment like I had never been destroyed before by alcohol or drugs. But I was devastated. I did not want to be alive. I left after my mandatory 72-hour hold, which the state of Georgia mandates. And I walked out of there with my hotel bag of stuff, my bag of hospital socks and my wonderful bracelet and, you know, all that great stuff. And I had to walk to the meeting and make him. And I went and I just sat and I couldn't do anything and I cried. I didn't want to drink. I didn't want to live. I didn't want to die. I didn't want to do anything. But that was the only thing I knew to do, was to go to that meeting. I was sober for a little while, a very short while, and I ended up maybe a month or so. And I had some inappropriate relations with somebody very early on. And one day I was confronted in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous about what I was doing. And I told everybody in a general way what I was doing as best I could. And at the end of that meeting, that man who confronted me came up to me and he says, you know, Bobby, I forgive you for what you've done. And either her and I will figure it out or we won't. He said, but I forgive you for your part. And he said, but obviously whatever power greater than yourself you have, it is not working for you. But if you would like for me to introduce you to a God of my understanding, I will be glad to sit down and go through the book of James with you. And I will teach you about forgiveness, and I will teach you about compassion, and I will teach you about some things about God that you've never heard about in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous before. I went in there and I did those things only because I got caught. I did not do it because I felt guilty or embarrassed or ashamed. That is totally different from today. Please note that. When I got caught, that was the only reason I did it, was because I got caught. Today, I feel a lot of shame and I feel a lot of embarrassment for the things that I did, but those are the things that ended up getting me to a God of my understanding today. That man did not come to my house. He did send a man from his house, or from his church, to my house. And for 8 weeks, we did go through the book of James. And I came to understand a God of my understanding that I had never learned about or heard about in here. And I do think that in the book where it says, hey, you can come up with your own conception, however inadequate, is sufficient. It is sufficient for sobriety. It is not sufficient for continued growth. Because at some point, I become as powerful as my higher power from the knowledge that I learn, and then I need to find a new higher power. My higher power has to continually, daily, weekly, become greater and greater and greater for me. May not be your story, but that's for me. So that was what? 1, 2, 3, step 3. So step 4 and 5. We've been here all weekend. You know, men have gone to workshops. Step 4 and 5 are great. They are very important for me. I've done several 4 steps and 5th steps over the years. The first one was probably pathetic. I got absolutely nothing out of it, I'm sure, other than the fact that I could say that I did it. As I've moved on in 4th and 5th steps, I've had the ability to really go back and find out those points in my life where my character changed or my character shifted in some form or fashion. And one that I found a couple of years ago, and this is what really the 4th step is intended for, is to go back and find these things. I was doing an inventory and I realized that I had made a very important decision in my life. When I was 4 or 5 years old, me and my dad had gone to a little convenience store to get something. I walked by the candy section. I picked up these 2 little jawbreakers that at the time in the mid-70s was maybe a penny, maybe a nickel. And I went up to my dad and I said, hey, I want you to buy these for me. And he said, no, go put it back. And I went back to put it back and I stuffed it in my sock. At 4 or 5 years old, I became a criminal. You know? what I took from that was, I cannot trust my father to take responsibility and take for care of me. Therefore, I am going to do what I have to do to take care of myself. And 4-year-old Bobby made a massive decision in his character to be a criminal for the rest of his life. That the only way for me to get things was to steal, was to take what I needed. And I was never going to trust you to take care of me. I was going to always have to do it for myself. And I was in my 40s before I realized that 4-year-old Bobby had made that decision so long ago, not to trust men, to take anything he needed for his survival. What I should have taken from that story was, I'm not always going to get what I want. And that was the fatherly decision my father was trying to teach me at that point in time. Not always going to get what you want. So that's my little short thing for 4 and 5. 6 and 7, the character defects and the shortcomings. Character defects are looking back and seeing where these defects have changed in my life. And 7 is looking at where I'm short and things that I should be doing in my life to be very considerate, to be very caring and compassionate of those people around me. But also in step 7, one of my favorite things in the 12 and 12 talks about in step 7 is humility and the importance of humility and what it is needed for. And there. And it says, indeed, the attainment of greater humility is the foundation principle of each of AA's 12 steps. For without some degree of humility, no alcoholic can stay sober at all. Nearly all AAs have found, too, that unless they develop much more of this precious quality than may be required just for sobriety, they still haven't much chance of becoming truly happy. Or, in adversity, be able to summon the faith that can meet any emergency. And so that was something that was taught to me, was humility as a protractor. If you have a protractor, you have 180 degrees. If you just want to get sober, Bobby, all you need are 5 or 10 degrees of humility. That's it. That's the overdose. That's the DUI. That's the losing of the job. That's the destruction of family. That is all the humility you need to get sober. That 5 or 10%. That's it. But my sponsor said, Bobby, but do you just want to be sober, or do you want to be truly happy? And I said, I want to be truly happy. And then he said, well, we need to figure out how to incorporate a little more humility in your life. And he started just to give me little assignments of things that I could do quietly, anonymously, to try and be a humble person, to become truly happy. I can talk about that 5% all the time. I overdosed, I lost the job, that's easy. But it's the other stuff, the attainment of greater humility, that makes me a much happier person. It makes me feel like I belong in this world. When I got to 8 and 9, this time, I had made a lot of amends before, and so I just went back to my family and said, look, I've relapsed again. I'm going to try and do the best I can. I can't promise you anything, but for today, I'm going to do the best I can to stay sober. I made those financial amends to the companies that I stole from. Made a lot of other amends that I needed to make. And I learned a very valuable lesson in 2016. I went to speak at a Georgia Conference of Young People's event that they had in Macon, and a bunch of people from Columbus came, my sponsor and such, and we were there, and my dad was there, and we were all talking and had lunch, and I went to the bathroom to change, and I come out, and that person that I had that inappropriate relationship was there. And it was like 4 minutes before I was about to speak. And she came up and she said, can I talk to you for a second? And I'm like, oh, great. I wasn't ready to make amends. I knew I needed to make amends. I just wasn't expecting it to be at that point. And the most one of the most miraculous things that have ever happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous, she said, "I want to make an amends for my part." And I realized for the first time that amends works both ways. I'm only responsible for my side of the street and cleaning that up. I need to allow you the freedom to do that. It's very shocking when somebody comes up and makes an amends to us, because people do harm us. The most valuable thing that I learned from that was all I had to simply do was say, "Thank you." And that was it. If somebody ever comes to me and makes amends, that's all I'm supposed to do is just say, "Thank you. I've cleaned up my side of the street." It does not mean people are not going to continue to harm me. My job is just to say thank you. When I get into 10, 11, and 12, I went to the meeting the other morning with the 10th step. And the 10th step gives a lot of great suggestions in the 12 and 12. There's five kind of ideas or suggestions to do that. But if they don't work for you, you have the freedom to talk to your sponsor and find a different inventory that works for you. Those are not mandates. And that was the great thing. Because like when I say I'm going to bed, I'm like asleep in 12 seconds. You know, there is no time for me to do a nightly inventory. It's just not possible. And sometimes when I wake up in the morning, my traditional routine is I get up and I feed the cat and I make a cup of coffee and I go to the bathroom and then I sit on the toilet and then I take a shower and then I make the bed. And when I make the bed, then I get down on my knees because I have to tuck the sheets. And I'll say my prayers, and I'll say the third step prayer and the seventh step prayer, and I'll bless a bunch of people. And then I'll pause and I'll say, "God, let's just go through this day, and I hope that I do your will today," whatever that may be. Some mornings I wake up, and this is what I love about the big book, is we have that third step prayer, but there's a sentence, a couple sentences after that, that's absolutely priceless. It says, the words are quite optional. So you can say the third step prayer however you want. Some days I wake up and I'm running out the door. I'm like, "God, I'm done. I'm going to work. We'll talk later." You know? And he's okay with that. He is okay with that. The way I pray and the way I meditate is for me only. I beat myself up a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous because I would go to meetings and Steve would be over there. He said, "I got up this morning and I made some Russian chamomile tea. And I went out on the porch and I watched the hummingbirds and the fog in the trees. And the sun rose so majestically and I was at one with God." And I'm like, my recovery is not like that. My relationship with God is not like that. I am okay with the way I have a relationship with God and the way I decide to pray and the way I decide to meditate. What's important is I allow you the same freedom. When I got to 11, I realized that it is extremely important in my sobriety today that my relationship with God is what I am dependent upon for my sobriety only. It is not you men. It is not this meeting. Because when I leave here, this meeting's not here and you men are not with me. I am going to be alone with the God of my understanding for the next 10 hours in my car. And he is the one that I need to make sure that I have a connection with if anything is going to hit the fan. He's the one that is going to keep me sober, no matter what. And that was very relevant when we talk in the I think it's the 12 and 12 that talks about it, or maybe the big book. Jerry, keep me correct. When it talks about the men who went off to war. And I think COVID was a very good test, too, of having the ability to stay sober just with a relationship. Because meetings were taken away. That connection that people relied on so importantly, that face-to-face fellowship was gone because of COVID. And I had to make sure that my relationship was strong enough, since all that was taken away, to stay sober. So now we're at having had a spiritual awakening. And I hope that the spiritual awakening that I've talked about tonight is one that I was able to carry sufficiently, and something that you gained something from. So I'm going to end on a couple of things. How much time do I have? I got 5 minutes? 7, 8, 12? 10? Okay, good. So I read that part from the religious point of view, because it just is so true for me. As I look back in my sobriety, I've seen so many things. So that point where Jim and Bob just showed up in Columbus from New York, and I was able to see that, somebody was talking about Alcoholics Anonymous changes my perception. And it's true. My perception are there's 200 men in this room. Your perception is there's one idiot up there behind a podium. Perceptions are different. And that's important for me to see that that has to change. And so my perception on seeing what God does for me over the years in my sobriety is very important. That man who forgave me for what I did, that was something that God definitely did for me. So back in 17, I was riding Harleys with a crew called the Straight Spokes Motorcycle Club, and enjoyed it. And several of us decided that we were going to ride cross country. There were six of us. So we loaded up, left Atlanta. We were going to California and then come back 3 weeks. And it was the longest vacation I ever took. And I had to take money out of the savings account and max out a couple credit cards and to do this and max out every bit of PTO I had at work. But I was going to go. Everybody else that went was retired. I needed to learn something from that. So this is what God does. So we're riding. We cross into Mississippi. We're across the Mississippi River. Stopped at a gas station. We're eating some chicken. We're smoking some cigars. And this transport van is circling the parking lot. And it pulls up in front of us, and this guy comes running out. And he's like, "Do you have a lighter?" I'm like, "Well, yeah, we're smoking cigars. So we have a lighter." So man got the lighter, and we're just talking. And I said, "Where are you being transported to? What's a transport thing to you?" He's like, "I'm not going to lie to you." He said, "I just got out of 36-day detox, and they're sending me to long-term treatment." I'm like, "My name's Bobby. I'm an alcoholic. These guys over here, we're all in recovery. Here's our phone numbers. If you ever need anything in Mississippi when you get out of treatment, you call us and we will come help you." That's what my God does. We continued on to our trip, and we were in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And we were at the Harley shop, and we got all our maps out. GPS was still there, it just wasn't that well yet. And so we're looking at the maps and we're deciding where to go. And this guy comes up and he's talking to us, "Where are y'all going?" And we're talking to him. And he's got a shirt on that says "Freedom Ride." And Eddie said, "What's the Freedom Ride?" He says, "Man, you probably wouldn't be interested in it." He says, "But a week before Sturgis, everybody that's sober that rides goes to Sturgis a week early to ride all those hills sober." And we said, "I'm Bobby, I'm an alcoholic. They're all in recovery." What are the odds? We hit California, we turn back, we're heading back. We're in somewhere Kansas. Okay? Somewhere Kansas hotel felt so bad that I had both guns on me because I did not feel comfortable. And so we park and we're at this roadside motel. Out there smoking cigars, waiting, and this minivan passes by a couple times and it parks, and these young ladies get out. And the first thing is like, "Hey, can we get some cigarettes?" And we're like, "Okay, we know what this is about." And so we give them a couple cigarettes, and we're like, "So what are y'all doing?" And they said, "Well, we're in this women's treatment center, and they let us out on the weekends so we can go out and resell these crosses. These cypress crosses with these 12-inch nails and this copper wiring. And we sell them for $20 so that we can pay for our treatment centers." I said, I'm Bobby, I'm alcoholic. We'll take six. And I have that cross at my house today. I don't know what your God does, but that's what I see my God doing for me. So I'm going to leave with two things. In 2020, before the pandemic hit, I had an opportunity to go staff a men's conference on Maui. And it's for another organization that I participate in. And I went a couple days early. I was going to camp and I was going to hike and do some things. And I went to some meetings. I said, look, my name is Bobby. I'm an alcoholic. I said, I lived here a long time ago in the early 2000s. And I used and abused these islands in a way that probably should never happen. And I am here just to make an amends to the Aloha spirit because I was disrespectful. And the people on the island said, we forgive you. And we were talking and they sent me, if you saw my big book cover, it has a whale. I have a spirit guide that is a blue whale. And they said, look, you need to go down here and talk to so-and-so. They're going to get you on a research vessel and they're going to take you out and look at whales. That would have only happened at a meeting at Alcoholics Anonymous. I think I paid like $12. I was out there for 4 hours watching these whales breach and their moms and their calves. And I went and did this weekend for these men, and it was done. And guy asked me, he said, hey, can you take me past Hana to where I live? And I said, yeah, I'm going that way anyway. I'm going to camp at the state park. And I said, but is there anywhere where you live that I could put up a tent? And he's like, well, I don't know, but you can call Auntie Jean at 12 o'clock at this number and ask. So I called, like, hey, Auntie Jean, this is Bobby. I'm bringing Cliff home. He says, you have some cabins. Can I rent one? She's like, sure, come on. I said, can I rent it for 3 nights? And she did, $75 a night. I had a shack. I had a 3 windows with screens and a sliding screen door, queen-size bed, coffee table, and a candle. And that was it. Absolute paradise. Absolute paradise. When we got to Hana, we stopped. They said, check your phone because you're not getting any reception. I'm scrolling, and this guy on a motorcycle pulls up, and he's like, hey, I'm from so-and-so. Is there anywhere I can pinch a tent tonight? And the cashier says, no, there's a state park, but you have to have a pass. And I said, hey, I have a pass. Would you like it? And so I gave him my pass to camp at that state park that I was going to stay at. What are the odds that some guy in America is riding a motorcycle on Maui and some guy from Georgia with a pass is at the same convenience store at the same time when one has something that the other needs? That is the power of my higher power. When I left that facility that I was staying at, it was like a compound. I left, and the name of that facility was Lokahi. And Lokahi translates to unity. And that's what we have here in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.